Ruchim Aboy, once again to everybody for the final stage of what's been a wonderful two-day special learning program, Yache Kaliya. Baruch Hashem, we've been zoiche of the last 2 days to introduce and to learn Torah with some new faces. A lot of new people came in here and have been learning. Those have come for the public speeches. And now we've reached Ne'ilah, the final stage of the Yache Kaliya, and it's a big schus, a big honor to have with us Rabbi Tetz, who in his own quiet way was a major inspiration in all of Ram starting 12 years ago and keeping it going. Big inspiration to me and a lot of the Rebbeim in the yeshiva. And he was here a few weeks ago and we spoke and he offered to come back again and we grabbed him. Just a couple of quick announcements. First of all, I've been asked to ask everybody, not that anyone's going to listen, but if you can please turn off your cell phones. We asked yesterday and we had about only 15 ringing in the shiur, so that's pretty good. If we try to cut it down to about 10 today, that would be even better. Also, just to let everybody know, the program that finishes today continues in a different format. Every day here we have learning every morning and every afternoon. Different programs, different shiurim, and also individual chavrusas available. Anybody who wants to come learn, you have an hour, you only have an afternoon, whatever you have. We have ongoing learning programs there every morning from around about 9 in the morning till 6, 7 in the evening. So anybody wants to join, just see myself or any one of the other members of the Koilel and the Yeshiva here. The Yeshiva and Koilel continues to learn here every day. And anybody interested in joining is more than welcome to join in. There are more chairs over there if anybody needs. I assume Rabbi Tetz doesn't need too much of an introduction, because if he did, none of you would be here. So I'm not going to spend too much time introducing him other than just thanking him very much. He's on a very busy, tight schedule. And coming from Yerushalayim to Beit Shemesh adds traveling time. And we have enormous hakaras hatov to him, enormously grateful that he's here. And we look very forward to hearing what he has to say.
First of all, we would like to thank Rabbi Sher for this opportunity to learn together. I'm sure it's obvious by now, but he has a remarkable talent for being able to organize Torah progress at a very surprisingly effective level, and that needs to be acknowledged and needs to be supported. I mean, I wasn't asked to say this, but it's obvious that all your MISO funds should definitely go to him right now, so that you can build this this type of program into something very, very dynamic and amazing. I thought what you might enjoy is last time we had the chance to meet, we spoke about a deep subject in Machshava. Let's turn our focus today to something a little bit different and talk about a life and death decision-making process, something more halachic, but I'll try to show you that there's a lot behind this as well that goes beyond the technical halachic. And that is the question that we call triage. In other words, how do you decide whom to save when you can't save everyone, right? You've got people dying, they need treatment, they need machines, they need your hands perhaps, and you can't decide, you can't save everyone. How do you decide, what's the halachic approach to deciding who dies and who lives? I have a special interest in this field. I wrote a book about this recently that's called Dangerous Disease and Dangerous Therapy. It's a very good book. You need to buy at least 2 copies if you want to understand it very well. And it has a large section on this. And I'll try to share with you some of the fascination of this area. You don't need to be a doctor to enjoy this or to need this material. Unfortunately, many of us who are not doctors will find ourselves in situations where you have decisions to be made, or you'll be on the receiving end with an elderly parent or grandparent when the hospital will tell you that someone else takes priority. And there are, unfortunately, we live in an ethos where the values of life-saving are not aligned with Jewish values. Quite a serious problem. In Israel, in some ways, no less serious, unfortunately, than elsewhere. So these could hardly be more relevant, these laws. So let's take a look at that subject and see if we can see some of the fascination of this area. Is that okay? Can we do that? Anyone? Okay. In order to approach this subject, let me give you an example of a very weird triage dilemma, and then we'll take a step back and look at some of the principles involved in this area, and then we'll come back and focus on bring what we've learned to bear on that particular question. Triage, you know, this old Napoleonic Wars term that was where you had large numbers of injured people in the First World War. Of course, you had situations like this, and the simplest triage protocol was you simply divided all the injured people into three groups. The so-called walking wounded, the ones who would survive anyway, those who were so badly injured that you couldn't probably do anything for them anyway, and you try to put all your effort into the third group who might live if you treated them and die if you didn't. Very crude way of dividing people up today, much more sophisticated protocols. In fact, tragically, a lot of the triage protocols used throughout the world have been developed in Israel. Right? When you do emergency medicine and they train you in triage protocols how to rapidly assess everyone who's been injured and decide who you save, the system that they use is a system that was developed here, unfortunately, and many critical and tragic questions have been raised here in Israel. Recently, someone asked one of the rabbonim here, when we come to an attack where lots of people are injured, are we allowed to walk on dying people to get to somebody we might save? We might extinguish lives in doing so, but we might save somebody. And that's a real-time question. Or when you bring in heavy machinery to excavate a building that's been collapsed, for example, an explosion. So in trying to dig out people to save them, you might crush others on the way, right? These are real questions. And unfortunately, of course, many of them have stemmed from Israeli situations. But triage in general means the question of making these very difficult selections. So let me share with you this particular question, which is a strange triage dilemma. And then we'll see how we would approach this. For those who'd like to look it up, you'll find this question in Tzitz Eliezer. You'll find a very detailed analysis of in Chelek Yud Zayin, Tshuva Ayin Beis, and also previous Tshuva in that volume. He has an extensive, a fascinating thing to see because he works through all the Gemaras and he shows you how this halacha has derived all the way from Psukim through the Gemaras all the way into halacha and Shalas and Tshuvas. Rav Sternbuch has also a short piece on this. But the question was as follows. A young surgeon in South Africa was, where all good things stem from, working in emergency surgery in the Johannesburg Hospital. I was no longer there working in that hospital at the time, so I can't tell you exactly what the technology was, but they had some new machine. The hospital had acquired a new ventilator or ventilator resuscitator, some very effective life support system, and they had only one. And the unit was being, this machine was being used in the unit there that's known as the accident service. There, you know, they have a emergency room unit, but they also have a dedicated trauma unit. And this is a massive institution. You're talking about a very busy hospital. The building is the biggest building in Africa, right? The Johannesburg Hospital is 1 kilometer long. In the ground floor corridor, you can see the curvature of the earth. Okay, literally. And at one end of this thing, they have a very advanced accident service with a helicopter service that brings in people from hundreds of pounds around. Very, very busy unit. And this unit had acquired this new machine. But they had issued a very peculiar instruction. The instruction was that no doctor on duty is allowed to use this machine on any patient whom he considers to be non-salvageable. Okay, what we call in halacha, chaye shah. We have chaye olam and chaye shah, right? Chaye olam means somebody who could be saved in the long term. Chaye shah means somebody who's terminally ill. Halachic, we actually define that as less than a year of survival. But if there's time, we can get into that. But let's say you have somebody's terminal. You're a trauma surgeon. You come on duty, let's say, 8 o'clock in the morning, you sit down there with your daf yomi like all good trauma surgeons do, and they tell you, doctor, somebody badly been injured. You rush over, you check out the patient, you can see this person's not going to live. You know, South African doctors can always tell exactly how long people are going to live. We never get that wrong. American doctors very poor at that. But we always get it right. And if you can see that this person's only going to live for a few hours, then under those circumstances, said the hospital, do not use the machine. What do you think was their reason? What would you say? They were concerned that if you put the machine on the first person and it's now committed to this person, and half an hour later somebody else arrives who's salvageable, you'll no longer have this machine available to save the second life. And in order not to get into that situation, don't use the machine in the first place. Use older technology, whatever you can do for the first person. If they die, they die. They're going to die anyway. Save the machine for the second person, right? The obvious challenge to that is, why don't you simply put the machine on the first person? When the second person arrives, switch the machine off of the first person. They're going to die anyway. And put it on the second. Why not do it that way? Why not? That's not what they said. The hospital gave the following reason. They said this: if you put the first person on the machine who's going to die anyway, and then an hour later someone else arrives who could be saved, when you walk over to the first person and switch off the machine, their family will object. There's shocked, traumatized family standing around this newly injured patient. There's going to be scenes of chaos and hysteria. They won't let you switch off the machine. We don't want you to get into that situation, and therefore don't do that in the first place. Now, Jewishly, that's completely irrelevant. The family's emotional response is not what is relevant in this situation. But for a Jewish reason, we would agree with the underlying concept, and that is that if you put someone on a machine and his life is dependent on it from moment to moment, in halacha, you're not allowed to switch that machine off. Because doing so is called killing the person. And even if you're doing it to save somebody, could be saved in the long term, we have a very basic principle called Ein Doichi Nefesh Mipnei Nefesh. You can't kill one person to save another. And this is very relevant. I'm sure there's people here working at Hatzalah, no? Somebody? Hatzalah people? No? Why not? If you do, so these are relevant questions, and you cannot push aside one life to save another, not even a life that is about to end, in order to save a long-term life. So let's rephrase the question Jewishly. You got this newfangled machine. You want to put it on the first person. If you do, you'll keep this person going for a few hours, let's say, which is definitely a chiyuv. Definitely have to do that. Where you're allowed not to treat someone and let them die is an interesting subject. There's time we can touch on that. But ordinarily, you have to give a person the best chance and keep them going as long as possible. But if you do that, half an hour later, someone else is going to arrive who could have been saved in the long term. You will now no longer be able to save this person because the machine's on the first person. And halachically, you could not switch it off on the first person. So this young surgeon who was working in this unit was concerned to know, does this accord with his Jewish obligation? This non-Jewish hospital is giving this instruction. Does it accord with his halachic obligation? So he went to one of the world's leading halachic authorities who happened to be there at the time, and he put this question to him. In addition, he added to this question the following detail. And you know, the way a shaila is asked in halacha is critical, because a hair's breadth of difference in the question can make a life and death difference in the output. So it's important to understand exactly the details of the question. He went to him and he said as follows. He said, this hospital is so busy that the scenario is guaranteed. This place is so busy that I can guarantee you that if I put a non-salvageable patient on this machine, while they're on it, someone else will arrive within the time they're on the machine, who's Jewish and salvageable, but let's leave that out. That's complicated enough. The second person's going to arrive. This place is so busy that it's statistically guaranteed. I'm not going to discuss today whether we accept such a notion halachically. Do we recognize the notion of a halachic, of a statistical certainty? But let's say that you do. There's no question that there are halachic situations where we certainly do with regards to Hilchos Shabbos and other areas. So let's assume for today that we're not going to debate the question about whether you can ever be statistically certain. Let's assume that you can, which means that you've got your first patient who's on this machine, and we know that if you put him on it, there's going to be someone else, not a Suffolk, but a vadai, someone else is going to arrive who could have been saved, and that person's going to die because you don't have the machine. What would be better to do? Obey the hospital, don't use the machine, keep it in abeyance, save the second person's life? Or does my Judaism require me to disobey that instruction, put the first person on the machine, be disciplined, maybe lose my job, who knows what they'll do to me? And not only that, watch someone die an hour from now. Because we're guaranteed to have somebody else who's going to come in within an hour, who's salvageable, could have been saved, and that person's going to die. Is the question clear? Yeah. Yeah, but here we don't have two equal situations. Here we have a definitely dying person now who cannot be saved, and a person that's guaranteed to be coming in, guaranteed, not a suffix. But one second. You're talking about a situation where we don't know whether my maneuver is going to help or harm. I'm guaranteeing you that the second person will be here and die. No, he doesn't. The second person in this case does not exist yet. That's true, but let's get this clear. The second person right now is mumbling at his wife from behind the newspaper at the breakfast table, not knowing that he's going to run into a truck on the highway in half an hour. He is up in Shemayim, they're looking down and saying, "You're in trouble today," but he doesn't exist yet. But he's statistically guaranteed to exist later. Okay, so that's... Me, I'm guaranteeing it. Me, I'm telling you. In halachic analysis, we always pretend that all the variables are guaranteed. Okay, well, this is a lab situation. The Gemara often comes up with the weirdest scenarios because it's putting the question into a lab situation, which is totally abnormal. We freeze all the variables and guarantee them. We move one under control situation and see what it does to the answer. Then we freeze that and move another one. Real life is never like that. But that's how you learn the principles. When you study any profession, when I studied medicine, the principles are always gloriously clear in black and white. But when you move into the real world, they're always swimming in shades of grey. Torah is like that too, by the way. Torah principles are always clear. But it takes the greatness of a posek who's got years of experience to call the decision in a situation where the shades of grey are varying. And depends which situation. You know, for example, when it comes to doubt in saving life, it makes a big difference if you're in a civilian situation or a military situation. You have to know that. Example, I had a meeting with a group of Israeli doctors some time ago. One of them told us about a colleague of his who's a senior Israeli army surgeon who's completely chiloni, nothing religious at all about him, who told him the following situation. He was sent into Lebanon with a group of soldiers and he had with him a paramedic. He's a very senior surgeon. He had with him a paramedic and a large group of soldiers. As they crossed the border, one of the soldiers was badly injured. This doctor said that he was certain that the injuries were so severe that if he radioed for a helicopter and had the man flown back to Haifa, he'd almost certainly survive, but only if he went with him in the helicopter. But to do that, he'd have to leave the soldiers without a doctor. But if he stayed and sent the man back with a medic, he'd almost certainly die. He said he had no idea what to do, what his obligation was. And he said for the first time in his secular life, he began praying very hard. And what happened actually was a big helicopter came and took them all. Now, that's not the point of the story, although, you know, it's the point of another story. But when he got home, he asked his friend, who's a religious doctor, what he should have done, and he went to Rav Eliashiv. And he said, what should he have done? Rav Eliashiv said, if that would have been a civilian situation, there's no question you have to take the injured man back home and save him. Because he's a Vadai, and the others are Sofek. They may be injured later, they may not be. Even though the injuries later may be many, and this is only one, but this is a Vada and that's a Sofek. And therefore, you take him back and save his life. But in the army, Rav Eliashiv said, you stay put. There, you do not use the same logic. And the reason is that here, we've already accepted the risk to life because this mission is necessary to save the country, whatever it is. And therefore, in those circumstances, you stay with the soldiers and you send him back. So how we handle Sfekus is another whole area. But anyway, this is our question. And this young doctor was given an answer by the rabbi, by the posek he asked. But then out of interest, the question was sent to Rav Waldenberg in Yerushalayim, and the two of them then sent the question to Rav Zilberstein in Bnei Brak. I actually had the honor of hearing this from him myself. I had the source of studying for many years in the shir that he gives to doctors there in Bnei Brak. And to this very clear yes or no question in Halacha, there were three completely different answers. Okay, and I'd like to share with you what those three answers were and how there's a life and death difference here hanging on a hair's breadth of halachic judgment. Of course, this young doctor was given his psak. You know, halachically, if you ask a rabbi for a psak halacha, you're bound by it. You cannot shop around. You know, you can ask 10 rabbis their opinions, you can make up your own mind. But if you ask for a psak, then you are bound by what you hear. And he was given his psak. Of course, that's what he had to do. But there were three opinions in general about this question. You know, if you ask a psak, you know, they have a joke about this. You know, the Barilan CD-ROM. You know, you can get a CD-ROM. Does every halachic question that's ever been asked? The joke about it is you tell it what you want to hear and it tells you whom to ask. Okay, that's not right, okay? That's not right. But let's take a look at this question. If you think about it, what we're dealing with here is a very weird triage question. Triage normally is you come to an accident, two people are injured, and you've got to make a choice, right? Do people stop at accidents anymore? I don't know. You know, in America, they don't stop because they don't want to get sued. In South Africa, they don't stop because they don't want to get AIDS. Where I live in England now, they don't stop because they're too polite. But be that as it may, you know, that's the normal trial situation, two people, and how do you make a choice whom to save? In our weird situation, we do have two people, but in a very strange way. We've got our badly injured person who's here now, who's not salvageable in the long term, and we've got another person who's salvageable in the long term, but he's not actually here yet. He doesn't actually exist yet. So it's a very strange type of trio situation. There are two people to decide between, but not in the normal sense of two people being right here now whom I have to decide between, right? So it's a very strange triage dilemma, but really it is a decision, it is a triage decision, and therefore let's see if we can learn the principles and apply them. So first of all, let me point out to you that triage is not only an emergency situation where you've got people in front of you. Triage is also much broader. For example, let's say you run the budget of a hospital. You're not a doctor at all. Are you allowed to fund a well baby clinic, you know, where they measure the kids and give them vitamins and all that, if you don't have enough intensive care surgical beds? That's a triage problem. Is a country allowed to spend money on its parks and museums if it doesn't have enough emergency and military facilities? That's triage at a political level. The Gemara says in the Dorim, if you have a city, imagine you have a city on a river where the water in the river flows past the city and it flows to a downstream city where there's only enough water in the river that if the upstream people drink, there'll be enough water for the downstream people to drink as well. But if the upstream people drink and wash, there'll be no water at all and the downstream people will die of thirst. What's your obligation as a Jew living in the upstream city? Are you allowed to drink and wash and let them die? Or are you constrained to drink only and give them enough water to drink? What would you say? The Maskana and the Gemara is, the conclusion is, the upstream people drink and wash, and they let them die of thirst. And the Gemara says, you know why? Because if they don't wash, there'll be an outbreak of hygiene-related epidemic among them, which may not kill them tomorrow, but it'll kill them the next day, and that's also called Pikuach Nefesh, and they can factor that in. So there's very broad things. I'll give you a classic example. A few years ago, there was a couple living in a certain European city, and after many years of marriage, they had no children. So they went to Israel. They ended up at a very, very slick fertility unit in the Tel Aviv hospital, and they had a child. They had a child. This couple happened to be exceptionally wealthy, and so the father, in his joy, made a massive donation to this hospital in Tel Aviv, stipulating that his money should be used to help other people have children. But this was an Israeli situation. I don't have to tell you that people here sometimes have their own quite fixed opinions. And so the hospital director said, no, I'm not taking your money for that. It's immoral of you. It's immoral of you to fund people to have children when I've got dying people who need to be treated. In my hospital, I've got dying people who need surgery, and you've no right, that's Pikuach Nefesh, you've no right to pay money to help other people have children when I've got dying people who are already in the world. So the man said, I'm not giving my money. You know, instead of just taking the money, you know, it reminds me of the Ponovicherov, who was a great and shrewd operator. He once had a friend who was exceptionally wealthy, exceptionally generous, but Jewishly a little challenged. And this man once promised the Ponovicherov enough money to build an entire yeshiva on condition that he promised that the students wouldn't have to wear these. The Rov promised, took the money, and he built a Beis Yaakov. That's what he did. He built a girls' school, and he kept his promise, and that's what he did. So, but in this situation, the hospital director did not have that presence of mind, and so they had a big fight. They went to Rav Eliashiv, and I heard this from his son-in-law. Rav Eliashiv said he's fully entitled to give his money to the fertility unit and help people have children. So the hospital director said, Rabbi, Pikuach Nefesh, what are you saying? Surely we save lives first. And Rav Eliashiv said an amazing thing. He said, a country needs a normal spread of facilities. Because when you start funding only emergencies, people get an embattled mentality. That affects their morale, and that's a life and death issue. You need very broad halachic shoulders to be able to make decisions like that, but that's what he said. So you have all these situations. Sometimes you get really weird ones. I mean, in Netanya, you know, Laniada Hospital is run on halachic line. Some years ago, a very wealthy American donated a kidney dialysis machine to the hospital on condition that it's only allowed to be used for tourists. Why? Because he was concerned that any American in kidney failure will never be able to visit Israel. Because when he visits Israel, no one's going to dialyze you in a country that doesn't have enough machines for its own people. So he put this machine for tourists into a hospital. An American in kidney failure will fly to Israel. He'll travel around the country. Every couple of days, he'll sleep overnight in Netanya and be dialyzed. And between sessions, he'll fly home. Well, you can guess what happened. The machine was put in, and right away, someone arrived who wasn't a tourist, who was in kidney failure. They went to the Klausenberger Rebbe. He said, absolutely, Pikuach Nefesh, put him on the machine. Now the machine is fully used. Do not ask me what would happen if a tourist and a non-tourist arrived at the same time. I have no idea. But that is another type of triage. So you get all kinds of variations. And not only that, in civilian medicine, for example, if you walk into the Royal Free Hospital in London and you say you got chest pain, the first thing you'll hear is triage. And somebody skilled at rapid assessment of your case will rush over immediately, and they'll assess you to see how urgent your case is. If they decide you're an absolute, total, amazing emergency, you only have to wait until Thursday. And if they decide that, you know, it's a normal emergency, you wait until, you know, January. But, you know, the point is that they stratify people in a hierarchy of urgency so they can apportion their stuff. And not only that, you know, it's well known that in a disaster scene, there are protocols. For one of the rules, for example, at a disaster scene is you're not allowed to treat anyone till you've triaged everyone. You got 20 people injured. The rules require you to make a rapid assessment of all 20 people before treating anyone. And you color code them. A black tag means the person's dead. Red tag, there's yellow tag. There's a whole system. Often does not accord with halacha, by the way. Often does not accord with halacha. For example, let's say you're rapidly triaging everyone and you get to someone who's dying, and if you move on, they'll die. Halachically, you're required to stay there. Right, in Tel Aviv, a young lady doctor found herself at the site of an explosion. She started rapidly assessing everyone. There was no one else there yet. She came to a 7-year-old boy bleeding badly from the neck. She put a finger on the bleeder and stopped his bleeding. And now she had a dilemma, because the triage protocol requires you to let the child die and assess 20 other people because you might save 5 lives. But halachically, it's not right. If now you are saving his life, you're not allowed to leave. Right? So we don't always agree with the secular criteria. Sometimes we do, sometimes we don't. But that is another whole fascinating area. So these are some of the issues that govern triage at a very broad level. But let's take a look at the triage criteria from the narrow point of view. Two people in front of you, how do you make the selection? Their picture's worth 1,000 words. Here's two people. Right, can you see them? Here's two people dying. I walk into the room. I see these two people are dying. I've got one pair of hands, right? And I can only save one. I've personally been in this situation a number of times. I was a military doctor in South Africa. I worked for 2 years as an army doctor. I had people who were shot and people who were injured. I had cases of 5-6 people injured at the same time. Before help gets there, you have to make a decision within seconds. And you have to know these criteria. So let's say I've got two people over here. I walk into the room. What's the first criterion I use to decide who comes first? What would you say? Any offers? That's a very good point. Let's assume they're both equally injured right now. What Mr. Goffman said is that the one who's quieter is probably more at risk. That's a very important rule that all emergency doctors use, is that the people who are screaming in pain, you can basically ignore. It's the people who are silent who are about to die probably. But let's say they're both equally injured and both equally threatened. So what would I use to decide between them? You know, the Americans always say, who's got insurance? Which is not, you know, which is not, that's not right. That's not right. Anything else? Yeah, it's interesting. You know, in New York, they always say, who's got insurance? In California, they always say to me, sex, gender. You know, if one's a man, one's a woman, right? By the way, if one's a man, one's a woman, whom would you save? Huh? What would you say, ladies? Yes. The consensus at this level is the man first, right? What would you say? The women. Why would you say women first? Because they can have children. Yeah. Men are also required, you know. I mean, maybe that point is not, you know. No, the Mishnah Horius, the Rav Moshe Feinstein says we don't use that, actually. Very interesting. Rav Shlomo Zalman and Rav Moshe, we don't use that coin before a Levi of Israel. Basically, that's not used. No, I tell you the most important or the most basic criterion is the one who's closer to me. If I walk in from here, I have to treat this person first before that person. What's the reason that you treat the person who's physically closest to you first? Because we have a klal ein ma'avirin ala mitzvahs. You're not allowed to bypass the mitzvah, right? When you put your hand in your tefillin bag in the morning and you take out the wrong one, you're in trouble. Because you can't bypass a mitzvah, right? So if you walk in from here and this person's closer, as you approach this person, you now l'chuyav, you're now incumbent on you, is the mitzvah of life-saving. You can't walk past it to an equal, more distant mitzvah. And therefore, all else being equal, and this certainly takes precedence over the Gemara and Horius, no question about that, that if the first person is closer, you have to treat that person first. What happens if I walk in from here? They're both the same distance. One's my brother, one's a stranger. Who'd you treat first? Your brother. Why did you treat your brother first? Because your mother will be upset? Why did your brother come first? The other fellow is somebody else's brother. Why does your brother come first? Why does the one who's closer to you come first? What? What's the reason? What's the halachic reason that a relative comes first? It's the same reason that stocker... Yeah. There's a comment here that you have to give relative stocker before strangers. Absolutely. It's based on the same rule. What's the derivation of this rule? Yes. The Pasuk says, Mipsocha al tisalem. You're not allowed to ignore your flesh. It's a Pasuk in Navi. And the Gemara says, because of that, you have to treat your relative first, parents before others. Actually, a wife comes before... In halacha, a wife is not regarded as your closest relative. She's regarded as you. There's the Chaim has chelukim based on this. Other relatives are called relations. Your wife is called you. Right? And therefore, she definitely... You know, you have to pay... Not only do you have to save your wife's life, you have to pay all her fines. You're not going to enjoy this. You have to pay all her fines. You have to pay her burial expenses. You have to pay all her medical expenses. You have to ransom her if she's captured by terrorists. I mean, if you didn't hire the terrorists in the first place to capture. But if you didn't... I mean, then you... You have to ransom her back from captivity, and you certainly have to save her life first, no question about that. But, by the way, that wouldn't apply in a hospital where the rules don't allow that. You're not allowed to save a relative first. If you're employed in some non-Jewish environment where they have rules that you're not allowed to prioritize a family member, then you would not be allowed to do that. The reason is that the facilities had not been made available for this in the first place. Apart from the halacha that you can't save somebody at the cost of someone else, right? Which is an interesting debate in halacha. But be that as it may, you save a relative first. And the interesting question about which relatives and whether an older brother comes before others, and that's a long discussion, but there's no question that the relation comes first. And of course, this is, in fact, the reason why you give tzedakah to people in your family before others, and all poskim agree doesn't only apply to family. Although the pasuk says mipsocha, it also applies to a friend, a neighbor, someone in your city comes before people in other cities, right? A cause in Ramat Beit Shemesh comes before elsewhere because you have devolving concentric layers of halachic responsibility. Although Jews around the world can prioritize Yerushalayim, and some poskim say all of Eretz Israel, equivalent to the town where they live, because notionally we all live in Yerushalayim. So that's clear. But apart from that, you are required to find your own city first. And therefore, the criterion is, I save the one who's related to me. Now, listen carefully. Use your black belt halachic expertise. What's the next question I'm going to ask you? Come on, make my day. What's the... Who? They're both strangers. That's not the next question. What? What? Jew or non-Jew? That's a good question, but it's not the next one.
I see the next question will be for me. Okay, I start to treat someone.
Yeah.
And right now, all of a sudden, I see the
yes.
next to him.
Yes.
About to die.
Yes.
Can I drop this and go to the next?
Not if he will die if you leave him. Rav Moshe Feinstein says once the person's been admitted, he's zoiche in the treatment, and therefore you can't leave him. You're right, but I want them to think about it. What's the next question to ask here? Come on. That's right, yes, of course. The next question is this. What happens if I walk in from here, the first person's closer, but my brother's further away? We have learned two priorities, right? One is proximity, and one is relationship. Which priority takes priority? That's the next logical question, right? What's the answer? No. This is one of the rare exceptions where you walk past the closer person, and you treat your brother. Okay? For homework, are we allowed to give homework? For homework, and every right question the Gabbai, I'm going to buy you a whiskey. Or cocaine, whatever you're into in Ramat Beit Shemesh. Why? Why does relationship come before proximity, right? They're both Torah-derived principles. Mipsach al tisalem is based on the Pasuk, and the Gemara has a derivation for Ein ma'avir al ha-mitzvahs. So how come we are ma'avir on a mitzvah to treat a brother? Fascinating question, and it's well worth... What? What? So what's the reason? So what's the reason? What's the reason in Stocker? What's the reason in Stocker you give money to your brother when someone else is closer who needs it now and he's in front of you? Why does the pasuk take precedence over en ma'avirin? It's also a Torah derivation. Think about it. It's worth a lot of thought. This is a fascinating question, right? I don't want to get into this now, but it's worth a lot of thought and it's a fascinating question. Nevertheless, the halacha is clear. You bypass the closer person. What happens if I walk in from here? They're both the same distance. One is a chaya ulam and one is a chaya shor. In other words, this person could live in the long term. This person cannot. He has some terrible disease that will cost his life within a couple of months. Okay? But right now, they've both been injured. They're bleeding to death. In 10 minutes, both will have died. If I save this person, he'll live in the long term. If I save this person, he's going to die in 3 months from his disease. Which one do I save? This is a no-brainer. Of course. There's many, many sources for this. You clearly save, if you need a source, you clearly save the long-term person. What happens if you walk in from here? The first person is a chayeshah. You can save him, but he'll die in 3 months' time. There's no question you have a mitzvah to do that. But the second person, if you bypass the first one, the second person will live in the long term. What do? You bypass the closer person? Yes, you do. You abandon him. And you walk to the person who is more distant and you treat him, unless the first person is conscious. If the first person's awake, you may not walk past him. Why? Because he will know he's going to die, and therefore? And therefore he'll die sooner. When a person feels I'm hopeless, they can't save me, abandonment, anguish, pain, depression, all those things are tangible, additive, lethal factors in Jewish thinking, and any experienced doctor knows that a person's emotional status is critical to their survival, and therefore you cannot walk past a person and make him feel that he's hopeless. But if he's not aware of what's going on, you walk right past him and you treat the person who is closer. So far so good. I mean, the person who is salvageable in the long term. So far so good? Okay, now here comes the key. Stay with me very closely. Notice what's happening. I'm walking past a Torah obligation. I have an absolute mitzvah of the Torah to save this life, pikuach nefesh, virtually the highest mitzvah in the Torah. And I have to save this person's life. But I'm walking past it because I have a prior pikuach nefesh obligation. And here's the rule. Whenever you break a Torah law, ignore a mitzvah's essay, or break a loisa essay in order to save life, there's one absolute criterion that you need. And that is that the person whose life you're trying to save must be here now. That's called the Chayle Lefanenu. The Nadiv Yehuda in a famous tshuva, and the Chasam Sofer also works on this, he says clearly that if you're going to break Shabbos to save a life, you can only break Shabbos to save a life that is here now. Any mitzvah of the Torah you want to break to save life, the red line is, show me the life. Doing research that involves transgressions because you may save lives future in the future, that's below the red line. Right? For example, in halacha, you're not allowed to dissect a dead body. Right? You cannot cut up a dead body. There are three potential Torah prohibitions involving cutting a body. Many poskim say it applies to non-Jewish bodies too, even though we don't usually hold that way. And the reason is that the human body is created with Tzelem Elokim, and that applies to non-Jews and Jews as well. But be that as it may, you cannot cut up a body to save... Can you cut up a human body to save a life? Absolutely, because the only things you can't do are sexual immorality, idolatry, and murder, right? Those you can't do. But if you're not going to transgress one of those, you transgress anything else to save a life, right? So you've got a person whose body you want to cut up. You want to cut up his body in order to save life. So cutting up a dead body is not murder, he's dead already. Okay? It's not idolatry unless you're strange. It's not sexual immorality unless you're very strange. And therefore, there's no question that you would cut up the dead body, right? So you get a person in your hospital, he's got yellow squares all over his body, flashing like a neon light, weird disease, and he suddenly dies. All the doctors want to get their hands on his liver and spleen and see what's doing. Nothing doing in halacha. No matter how interesting this is, you're preparing for burial. Suddenly the patient in the next bed starts flashing and gets yellow squares. Halacha says you go fetch the first person's body and you cut him up now. Why? Because there's a chayle lefanenu. There's somebody in front of us now whose life may be in danger. The degree of risk to his life is almost irrelevant. And the degree of probability of saving him is almost irrelevant. Because when it comes to pikuach nefesh, we don't use roif. You know, halachically, in all other areas, we use the principle of majority. Right? If you're cooking a meat stew and a few drops of milk fall in, don't try this at home. But if a few drops of milk accidentally fall into your meat stew and it's negated, it's bottled in the roif, if you throw it out because you think you're being religious, you're guilty of wasting. And therefore, roif defeats a mute, but not in pikuach nefesh. There, no matter how small the minority virtually, right? You know how extreme this law is? Let's say you're walking down the street one night, lost in thought, and you hear a baby's cry, and you search around and you find an abandoned newborn child in a garbage can. It happens. You pick the kid up and you brush off the fish bones, and you save the kid's life. What is one of the questions at some point you're going to have to deal with? Is it Jewish? How do you decide whether an abandoned baby is Jewish or not? Right. If he's abandoned in an area that most people in that area are Jewish, he's a Jewish baby. If you find him in an area where most of the residents are non-Jews, he's a non-Jew. So let's you find him in some non-Jewish area, and you hand him over to the non-Jewish authorities, and they bring up the kid in the local Catholic orphanage. He eats unkosher food. He's a Catholic kid. 10 years later, you hear that his life's in danger. You have to save his life. Because the fact that you just diagnosed him as a non-Jew on the basis of a roiv doesn't apply to pikuach nefesh. Isn't that weird? That's what the post can bring. So
there's very serious things. Let's assume there's two people in custody.
Yeah.
Two Jewish people. Yeah. We don't like that people will be dissect after death.
Yes.
We're against it.
Yes.
Right now, your loved ones, Lorena, passed away.
Yes.
And the same time, next Jew died.
Yes.
Doctor will cut your loved ones and give liver. It's okay?
Yes. To take an organ from one person to another to save a life is okay. Unfortunately, in practical reality, they take the organs before the person's dead. That's
but halakhically, he has right to cut your relatives and give liver if somebody died in this
one. So some poskim say like this, that to take an organ from a dead person to save a life, you can do even if the person refused permission. Because he didn't give permission for this, but you've got pikuach nefesh in front of you. Others say it depends on his permission because it's covered ames, and the dead have no mitzvahs. It's his body, and it's his covered, and he has no mitzvah to save a life now, because he's dead. And the dead people don't have a mitzvah, because nefesh, and you cannot take his organ. In practice, this doesn't happen, because the law of the land doesn't allow this, but that's a fascinating issue. You need to read my book, and then you'll see all the laws about that. By the way, in Israel today, all poskim, starting with Rav Unterman, have agreed that Israel is considered pikuach nefesh in general, and therefore in Israel, bodies are cut up to extract skin, bone, corneas of eyes, which are banked in case soldiers need them. Since you're facing a military threat, there's no question that even though there's no one lifaneinu right now, but that's called a real and present danger, and so organs that can be taken after death, not like hearts and livers, but things like bone and skin, which can be taken well after death, those things are banked and frozen so that we have them in case soldiers are going to need them. A soldier needs to know that if he gets injured, these things are available. Anyway, that's another fascination. So, we are talking about bypassing. Now, so the criterion is you need someone to be present, right? To break Shabbos, to eat on Yom Kippur, to eat unkosher food for pikuach nefesh, we need a chole lefaneinu. Now, listen to this. The Noda Behuda makes it plain that lefaneinu doesn't mean in the same room. What is lefaneinu? Same room, same city, same hospital. What's lefaneinu? And it comes out very clearly from his tshuva that lefaneinu does not mean geographical proximity. Lefaneinu means a real, present, identified individual. For example, all Western countries now give transplants based on a computerized national matching list. So all the recipients waiting for kidneys are listed, and as soon as kidneys become available, there's a computerized antigenic matching program, and the next best match on the list is going to get the kidney. He may not be in the same city, but because he's available. Do you know this is amazing? Do you know that nowadays, just to show you how fascinating this is, and if this doesn't move you, there's no hope for you. Do you know that in America now they've been doing a thing called cross transplants? Means, let's say for example, you have a mother willing to give a kidney to her child, but her kidney doesn't match. They find another mother who's willing to give her kidney to her child who also doesn't match, but they match each other. So Mrs. A gives a kidney to little B so that Mrs. B will give a kidney to little A. And they get both mothers to sign, and they start the operation on the mothers at exactly the same moment so that neither one can back out. They start the anesthetic at the same moment. They extract the kidneys. They fly them to each other's cities, and each kid gets the other mother's kidney. And a few months ago in America, they did 10. 10. You know what that means? Mrs. A gave a kidney to little B so that Mrs. B will give a kidney to little C, so that Mrs. C gave a kidney to little D. 10 kids got a kidney from somebody else's relative. Isn't that amazing? Isn't that amazing? Even if you're English. Anyway, so there you can have, but lefaneinu does not mean geographical proximity. I'll give you an extreme example. In 1986, A baby was born in California in heart disease. Child was dying. The surgeon was a famous chest surgeon called Norman Shumway. And he decided for the first time in history to try and transplant a heart into a newborn. 1986, heart transplantation only began in 1968 in a certain country. We didn't, of course, mention where it was, but in a certain country. Be that as it may, by 1986, nobody had tried to transplant a newborn heart. But since there was no other hope for this child, he decided to have a try. What's the hardest part of transplanting a heart into a newborn? Where do you find a heart? They scoured the United States and they found a child available to be a donor in Vermont. But Vermont is 3,000 miles away from California, but there was no other hope. So they hired a private jet. They put the youngest surgeon in the team into this jet in California. He flew across the country to Vermont, cut out the heart of the donor child and put it into a box of cold cardioplegic solution, and they couldn't get the jet to start. They couldn't get the plane started. They ended up scrambling United States Air Force supersonic fighter, put this terrified young surgeon in the back of a supersonic fighter with a heart in a box on his lap. When they got back to California, they had to resuscitate the surgeon. But they did, and they saved the life of the baby in California. That 6,000 miles, halachically, is called the Fanenu. Because the point is not proximity. The point is a real, extant, identified person. Okay. Now, are we all clear on the... Okay. Let's come to our question of the ventilator, and let's apply what we've learned, and you are going to solve the problem. Now, I'm sure they came to think, right? So, let's ask the following question. Here's your 8 o'clock in the morning, come on duty, trauma surgeon, and you rush over, you check out your patient, you can see there's no hope for him. But you have your newfangled machine, and you'd like to put it on, but just as you're about to connect the machine, you see the door open, and you see they're wheeling in a chaya olam. That person is salvageable, this person is not. He's closer, but he's salvageable. Would you quickly put this person on the machine and let that person die? Or would you hold this patient off, wait until that person gets here, and put the machine on the second person? Who would you give it to? Second person. Provided the first person is not conscious. Correct. He's hopelessly unconscious, no hope of regaining consciousness, doesn't know what's going on. Is from here to the door called Lefanenu? Brilliant. Number two, 8 in the morning, badly injured person, about to put the machine on, the phone rings. On the phone, they tell you that the ambulance is on its way. 10 miles away in the ambulance is a salvageable patient. You wait 10 minutes, you'll save his life. Do you wait?
Wait.
Is 10 miles called the Fanenu?
Yes.
Beautiful. Number three, you're doing great. 8 in the morning, injured person, about to put the machine on. The radio crackles to life. On the radio, they tell you that the helicopter's on its way. 150 miles away in the helicopter, they got a salvageable patient, Chayolam. If you wait an hour, he'll be here. Do you wait?
Yes.
150 miles, Lefanenu?
Yes.
Now listen very, very carefully. 8 in the morning, badly injured person about to put the machine on. No door opens, no phone call, no radio call. But there's a statistical guarantee that someone's going to be here in half an hour. Is a statistical Lefanenu? Whoa, you have to enjoy the question. One second. Isn't that an amazing question? Is a statistical Lefanenu called Lefanenu? Isn't that beautiful? You see, I would say we do a Chakira. A Chakira means you take a lachi subject and you cut it so finely that you show that there's more than one issue. Normally Lefanenu means there's a person in front of us whose life I would like to save. But there's actually two variables. There's a person whose life I'd like to save. In our weird situation, we have no person, but we have a life to be saved. Because there's a guarantee that he'll be here. Right now, he hasn't been injured yet. But I can promise you that if I put the first person on the machine who's going to die, within half an hour, someone's going to be here who will die. So it's not Lefanenu physically, but somebody's going to die. What's the concern of Lefanenu? Is it this person you can see? Or is it the guarantee of saving a life? What would you say? So I'll tell you what happened. Is that the psak he was given, this young doctor was, the hospital's correct. You don't have to lose your job, hold off the machine, do not use it on the first person, and wait till the second person gets here to save his life. The second opinion was that, I think it was Diane Weiss actually, I think he said that this is not called the Fanenu, you use the machine now, what will happen an hour from now, you'll have to deal with then. And the third opinion was amazing. The third opinion was of Zilberstein, and he suggested this about 20 years ago. He said, and it's about to happen, he said, here's what you do. You take your patient, the first badly injured person who's hopeless, you take your newfangled machine, and you attach to this machine a clock and a bell. And here's what you do. As soon as the first person arrives, without a moment's hesitation, you hook him up to the machine, set it running, set the timer running. The machine runs for half an hour, the bell rings to warn you it's about to switch off, and the timer switches off the machine. You rush over and switch it on again. The machine works for another half hour. The bell warns you, it switches off, you switch it on again. You keep doing that until the second person arrives. When the second person arrives, you wait till the machine switches off, and instead of switching it on the first person, you switch it on the second. Now, whether Johannesburg Hospital would like Shabbos clocks on its ventilators, I don't know. But unbelievably, it's about to happen. Unbelievably, although it was a radical suggestion at the time, I was at Mount Sinai Hospital in New York some time ago. I had to give a talk to the ethics committee there. They told me they're considering putting timed cutoffs on all the ICU ventilators. Right? And there's a very good reason for this. Not only is it, the first glance look, is this simply a cowardly way of switching off machines at a distance, right? So we don't have to do the dirty work. That's not correct. Eliashiv actually was consulted about this. Shari Tzedek and Hadassah have just built a machine like this. They've run successful trials on models. The Knesset has approved it. They're now waiting for final Knesset committee, subcommittee, insurance committee, nothing to do with the morals or ethics of it, before running a human trial. And the reason is this, and I'll finish with this, but it's an amazing thing. The reason is this, that an ICU doctor's nightmare, and I've been in the situation myself, and it's an absolute nightmare, and it stops you sleeping at night, is that when you get a patient who's in respiratory failure who needs a ventilator, your fear is, if I put this person on a machine, I may never get him off. And if I never get him off, and he's going to die gradually in 3 to 6 months, during all those months, the other people that could have been saved that I never saved. And the real fear is if we have a swine flu epidemic, or an avian flu epidemic, right, where lots of people come in. There's a young rabbi from London who's a rabbi in Detroit. When I visited there some time ago, he told me that the first thing that happened when he arrived in Detroit was they put him on the local, all the religious authorities in the area, they put on the local hospital's ethics committee. And the first question the ethics committee had to decide was, if there's a swine flu epidemic and lots of people come in dying of respiratory failure, who will we save? They decided that they'll ventilate all children and send all adults home to die. You've got to make choices, right? So what will happen in those situations? So here's what happens. When a hospital is faced with a situation of a person with respiratory failure, what they do is this. They say that if we put this person on a machine, we will never get him off. So what do? You try your best to assess who looks most likely to survive. Who looks most likely to recover if you treat him with a ventilator? And you take only those people. And the people you think won't survive, you send home to die. Because you only want to put people on your machines that are going to get off them so you can have the machines for other people. But you cannot get that perfectly right. And every day people are sent home to die without being given ventilation because they don't look likely to survive. There's no question that people who could have survived are being sent home to die. That's a terrible situation to be in. So here's the new suggestion. Don't do that. As soon as anybody comes in respiratory failure, don't make their judgment, put them on a machine. But say to the patient, my dear sir, you have two options. Either go home and die, or we'll give you a trial of therapy. We'll put you on a machine that's only going to run for 5 days. In the next 5 days, if it becomes apparent that your viral pneumonia is getting better and you're recovering, then we'll keep the machine going. But if it becomes apparent at that point that you're hopeless, when the machine switches off, we are not going to switch it on again. What we'll do is we'll switch it on somebody else. And therefore, if you think about it carefully, we are not setting machines to cause people to die. We're giving people an extra week of life that they wouldn't have had otherwise. You better believe it, but it's better than going home to die. At least this way you know that if your lungs show signs of recovery, they'll treat you. But if your lungs become apparent that they wiped out completely, you couldn't have survived, at least you live 5 extra days. Hadassah's about to run a human trial, and they've chosen an interesting group of patients for the human trial. They've chosen people with degenerative diseases who are gradually losing the ability to breathe. Neurological diseases that within weeks to months they will stop breathing. Out of those, they've taken a subgroup of people who have signed that they don't want to be put on machines when they can no longer breathe. I want to die with dignity. Do not put me on a permanent machine. Let me die when the time comes. They've gone to those people and said, do us a favor. Let us put you on a machine when the time comes and keep you alive from 1 week extra. And then we promise you, at the end of the week, when the machine switches off, we will not switch it on again. Why have they chosen that group of people? So that nobody can accuse them of having caused people to die sooner. The worst you'll be able to accuse the researchers of is having kept people alive a week longer before allowing them to die. And all of these people have said, of course, if we can help other people, absolutely, keep us going a week extra. And so they're about to run the trial on humans. By the way, it took a long time to develop the electronics to switch off the machines. It was a major technological computer problem to develop a timer that would switch off a machine at a particular time. Why? Isn't it a simple problem? Go to your local home base, whatever you call it. What do you call it here in Beit Shemesh? Tambur. Go to your later tambur. Get a Shabbos clock. Stick it in the socket. Put your ventilator into that. Set the timer and switch off. Nothing could be easier. What's the problem? ICU ventilators refuse to switch off. When you cut the power, they start squeaking and squawking and alarming. They've got batteries that do not switch off. So they had to build a circuit that would guarantee that it would switch off when you want, but not defeat all the alarms and the fail-safe. That's not a trivial problem. It's a life and death challenge. They're now confident that they got the electronics right, reliable enough. They're about to run a human trial. And I have no doubt that soon coming to a hospital near you will be all ICU ventilators will be on machines, because there is a constant threat of overloading the facilities. This will be a way of giving people trials of therapy so that we do not have to turn away people, and we can give people a chance to see who will recover and who will not. If any questions before we close, yeah.
Based on the idea of the circle over the time, it's crazy. Doesn't that mean that everything is allowed
to turn up? No, this has to be guaranteed that the person will be here. Sometimes halachically we accept that, sometimes we don't. For example, let's say on a big moshav with more than 1,000 people, so the psaki is that the ambulance or the chovesh or the nurse is allowed to break Shabbos to go to where he may be needed for the next call, even though there's no call yet, because it inevitably happens on a Shabbos. That's already called as if it's lefanen. There are plenty of piskei halacha that depend on that. Yes, any final question? Okay, thank you.